Welcome to the Uplift Chronicles, where we journey through the powerful stories of those who inspire, uplift, and make a difference. I am your host, Kofi Dake. In each episode, we dive deep into the lives, accomplishments, and the diverse backgrounds of remarkable individuals, particularly those of Afro heritage, who are changing the world one story at a time. Whether you are seeking motivation, connection, or a celebration of culture, you are definitely in the right place. So sit back and relax, and let's explore how lives have been uplifted, both in Africa and across the globe. This is the Uplift Chronicles.
There are many African tribes. Our ancestors have documented through various forms the history associated with their respective tribes. There is one tribe in particular that is believed to have history and customs of Hebrew. Mrs. Seyram Ajanku, who has conducted extensive research and teaching on the Ewe people, is here to discuss the topic, who are the Ewe people and their origin, with me. Welcome to the Uplift Chronicles once again, Seyram.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here. I am very proud to be considered worthy of this platform.
We had such a great time the last time you were here, and our audience wanted us to bring you back. I also promised to bring you back to discuss the topic, who are the Ewe speaking people and their origin. Would you like to add anything more about yourself?
Sure, yeah. So I am a bona fide Ewe child. I am so proud of my Ewe roots that, you know, I think I exude it. But anyway, my name is Seyram Ajanku, and I am from the Volta region of Ghana. But you can say I'm from Ewe Nyigba, that is Ewe land. In fact, I did my DNA and it actually shows percentages from all the way from Nigeria, actually Central Africa too. And then Nigeria, Benin, Togo, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Burkina Faso. So that's, you know, as broadly as the Ewe is scattered, that is what is shown in my DNA. So I can say I'm a bona fide Ewe.
Wow, the DNA findings is very impressive. And actually, you've lived in multiple countries as well.
The DNA was gravitating
you towards those travels.
or my ancestors just didn't stay in one place. Yes, that is true. Yeah, so in a nutshell, that's about me. I grew up in Ghana and in Mali and in Togo. I also came to the United States for my university, and I attained a master's in nursing. And although I'm passionate about nursing, my second passion is African Hebrew, especially Ewe history, linguistics, and culture. So that's been my focus for the last few years now.
Nice. Yeah, that's very impressive because I've listened to some of your teachings on YouTube. Very impressive and enriching. Yeah.
Yes.
So we know that Africa went through the transatlantic slave trade and colonization. So many ethnic groups in Africa were divided through the borderlines that were created. So how did the Ewe people manage to stay together throughout this period? I did pick up something on library project through one of your teachings. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Okay. So, you know, in my view, the Ewes did what they could, because the Ewes were nestled between the three most powerful kingdoms within West Africa at the time. We're talking about from the 17th century all the way up until the late 19th century, right? And so you had kingdoms like Oyo, which is in present-day Nigeria. Then you had Dahomey, which is in present-day Benin. And then you have Asante, which is in present-day Ghana. And the Ewes were nestled between those three kingdoms. And the three kingdoms were powerful kingdom in the sense that they had an organized standing military. And they were able to wage war on their neighbors for this or that reason. the Ebers, because the Ebers were not, they did not have a central power. They unfortunately received a lot of the brunt of that strength that the other kingdoms gained. You know, in Eber history, we know that at some point in our history, we were under a very powerful king who enslaved us, right? Enslaved the Eber people according to the Eber history and made life very difficult for us. And so when
tyrants.
Yes. The tyrants called, popularly called Agokoli. So when the Eber people were able to free themselves from that bondage, they made a vow to themselves that they would never be ruled by one single king again. And so they established small kingdoms all throughout the Eber land, which is what the Europeans named the slave coasts of West Africa. Unfortunately, our land, all the way from the Volta River in Ghana to what is Lagos, Nigeria, close to Lagos, Nigeria, all of that land was Eber land.
Okay, so
during the
Benin, Nigeria.
Exactly.
The south.
Yeah, and into the interior as well, all the way up to the far areas, you know. So all of that place was considered Eber land, and that is what the Europeans dubbed the slave coast. And so just as the meaning says, slave coast, that is where they captured a lot of people by allying with the powerful kingdoms that surrounded us, providing them with ammunition and, you know, strengthening them in order for them to be able to do slave raids against us and capture us and sell to the European. So even till today, people in the most African blacks in the diaspora who are descendants of slaves in the US or in South America, in the Caribbean, when they do their DNA tests, they will find some Eber in there. They are bound to find some Eber because the Ebers were actually the most enslaved from the inception of the trade.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, taking you back to what you said, so initially the Ebers did not have a structured, a leader or a king, right? So how were they structured? They were still as a unit though, right? Without a leader, or they have various leaders, but without a paramount chief. How was it
structured? They didn't have a centralized power.
Okay.
It's like, you see how Asantehene is there. He's like the centralized power of the Asantes.
Okay. Right?
Even though they have chiefs and all those, the Ebers didn't have a centralized power during the time of slavery. So, but they did have structure, but it was in their small communities, small divisions. And being that during that time, of course, information doesn't flow like it does today. By the time the information gets to the next town, the war or the raid has already taken place.
And that's how they got enslaved more.
Yes. Now, the Ebers also, whenever they were attacked like this, their soldiers in their small communities also resisted and captured some of the people attacking them, and they would sell their war captives to the Europeans as well.
Well, all right. So also, you did in the library project, you did mention something about the Kingdom of Judah, the slave coast, and then the Ingba. Those three. Can you elaborate on those three?
Yes, actually, the Portuguese named Ouidá. Ouidá is was a kingdom, was an Eber kingdom that is in present day Benin.
Okay.
So it was an Eber kingdom up until about 1724 to 25 there, where the Dahomey invaded and they did slave raids and scattered the kingdom. So the Portuguese had already been coming to those areas for quite some time. In fact, they first established their first slave, their first trading post in Elmina, which is in present day Ghana.
And the Elmina Castle utilized, they built the Elmina Castle?
No, they established it as a trade post. The castle you see today is not how the Portuguese built it. Others also came and took over, like the Danes You know, and they also added to it. So what you see right now is actually a result of later colonization by the Danes. But at the inception, it was the Portuguese who established that place, and they named it as El Mina, which means the mine, the mines, right? Because they were trading also gold, they were trading other commodities with the natives in those areas. And they started doing those activities around 1470s. Now, in 1492, the Portuguese kingdom, the papacy, because they were ruled by the Catholic organization. So the papacy issued an edict, which commanded that all of the black Jews of Portugal had to be deported or captured and enslaved. They deported them to West Africa.
Okay, so from Portugal, from Portugal.
From Portugal, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So if they refused to convert to Catholicism, so from there, they had a lot of people that they captured from Spain and Portugal and deported them into the west coast of Africa. So that's in around 1492. So several years before then, the Portuguese had already established trade posts along the coast. So yes. El Mina is one of those places. Uh-huh. And then they also were doing trade throughout what they dubbed the slave coast later.
Yes.
And it went all the way down to the Congo area and Sao Tome and Principe as well. That is more West Central Africa. So they had various trade posts all along the coast, and they used those trade posts to also deport the black Jews from Spain and Portugal to those areas. So you had one way of Jews. A Jew is really somebody who originates from Judah. Okay.
Yeah. My next question on that, you're calling them black Jews.
Yeah. It's not necessarily a modern day Israeli, the white people over there. A Jew in those days was synonymous with a black person who was the descendant of Judah. Okay. Right. So that was one way how the black Jews got into West Africa. But another way is how our oral tradition tells us, which is that we came from what is called Israel. But in our art forms, like in songs and drumming, drum language and poetry, we always refer to the land as Cana, right?
Okay.
Right. Or Cana. Exactly. So the Portuguese, they had seen when they came and they were surveying the area and the people, they realized that we were actually Judeans. In fact, they wrote about it. They wrote about how the inhabitants of those places were Judeans, that they were the part of the tribes of Israel. So they called the kingdom that is popularly known as Wida today, they called that place Ajuda, which means Judah in Portuguese language. And so the English explorers who came later, they started, you know, because they translated the Portuguese maps, right? So where they saw Ajuda, they also put on their map Judah, Kingdom of Judah. So that is where the name of that place came about, that was known on those maps as the Kingdom of Judah. And it is not simply because they thought it was fancy. It's because they actually knew that the people there were Israelites, they were Judeans, and they had also previously deported some Jews from their own kingdoms into those areas.
So this area, is it the whole coastal area that they referred to, like, you know, Judea, or is just that specific geographical area around Benin, present day Benin?
Right. So they named the slave coast, which is Eveland, Kingdom of Judah. But the town, the kingdom that was specifically attributed to Kingdom of Judah was Wida. Yeah. So on the map, they'll say they put something like Kingdom of Judah / slave coast. That's how they wrote it.
That makes sense. And then, so where did the Yingba come from?
That's how we call it ourselves. We don't call our land Kingdom of Judah. We call our land Ebe because we call ourselves Ebe people, right? We call ourselves Ebe. And actually, that name Efe is found in the name of Mauga, which is what you would call God, the Most High God. The name of Mauga, and it's in the Bible. Some may think that the Bible is a religious book. It is not. The Bible is first and foremost a history and culture book. Before it was used to do religion, the Bible was first in oral form before it was written down. And we, the descendants of the people of the Bible, the Israelites, we continued passing on these histories in oral form. You understand? So
yeah, you know that will cause some waves, right? When you tell somebody, okay, let's say there are people that actually believe that the Bible is a religious book inspired and was written by men who were inspired by God, right? And you're saying that it was actually a history book, and then religion kind of engulfed it and moved with it to the present.
Yes, exactly. They would think that, but there is no evidence that it was a religious book from its inception, right? Because you have a people who had a way of life. They had their culture, they have their customs, their traditions, and they had their God.
Right.
You know, and along the line, some of their histories, it's not all the histories of the biblical Hebraic people that is documented in the Bible, right? So some of their histories began to be written, and those writings were later compiled, much later compiled and bound together. And that's what you have as the Bible. But before they were written, they were only passed down through oral tradition. That's how they were designed to be done. In fact, I forget the exact quote, but they're somewhere in Leviticus where the God of Israel is commanding Moses to write down the instructions. No, not to write down, but to the instructions to their children and their children's children until the coming generations, they should tell it to them. And that's what we've been doing. We tell our stories.
Yes.
It's oral tradition.
Oral tradition.
That's how it's been long before it was written. And then those writings were seized and confiscated during wars and invasions because, you know, the history does tell us that we've been through a lot of those as well.
Yeah. That's interesting how history was passed on, especially in the sub-Saharan area and other places through oral tradition through oral tradition. That was good. And so I guess it kind of helped out because even though some of the things were destroyed physically when they were stolen and taken away, but people still had more tradition within them.
Yes. And that is why we still, our oral traditions till today corroborate the biblical accounts. And when we tell our oral traditions, some people may think, oh, they just took it from the Bible. But no, this has been oral traditions that have been passed on. And actually, some of them even corroborate the oral traditions of our brothers and sisters who find themselves in Southern Africa and Central Africa and some parts of Eastern Africa. And that actually also corroborates our histories that tell us that when we got up to move at each point, some of our people went south.
Right.
You see, so before, and then the rest of us Ebers ended up in West Africa.
Yeah. So now, Egypt, Israel, and the Arab people, the Arabic people. So what is the relationship between these three?
So as far as Egypt, there is a lot of relationship with Egypt when it comes to the Arab people. Of course, Israel, we are descendants of Israelites. And as you've seen on my channel, I talk about it a lot. I have lots of teaching videos where I go into the histories, the linguistics, and the culture and all these things. But as far as Egypt, I think we haven't really delved into unfolding the evidences that are the ever evidences that are found in Egypt. But actually, there are a lot. You can find it in names, you see, and that is the extra biblical evidence which is still in our linguistics. You can find it also in the biblical evidence, which tells us that the Israelites were in Egypt for approximately 400 years. They were not slaves for 400 years in Egypt, but they were in Egypt and doing well for at least 150 years before they, you know, the tides turned against them and they became enslaved. Let me give you an example of the linguistics when it comes to Egypt. So there was a pharaoh that, well, for Egypt, just as it is in the culture today, when a king comes into power, he takes on a name.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And the name he was given at birth is no longer used.
Okay.
Now, and that was the same practice in Egypt. There was a pharaoh that took on the name Amenhotep the first. It's pronounced Amenhotep today, according to the scholars, right? Okay. Based on the information they have. Now, the story about that pharaoh is that he came into power after his father had died, and his brother, who was supposed to succeed his father, also died. And so he was the unlikely candidate, but he became the pharaoh, and he took on the name Amenhotep. Now, in Ewe culture, when a child is born, when a son is born and the father passed away during the birth circumstance of the child, right, or other family members passed away while the mother was pregnant and was about to give birth, right, that child would be given the name Ametepe or Ameotepe. You understand? Do you see the correlation here?
Yes. So which translates to like somebody who replaces
another. Replacement, replacing others, replacing those who have left, who have gone. Right. And so now we see in ancient Egypt, we see this pharaoh taking on the name Ameotepe. I would confidently argue that the name is Ameotepe and not Amenhotep.
Yeah, archaeology.
Yes, because of the history surrounding how he came about and how he gave himself that name. So that's one example of the names being in Egypt. And then we have some similar cultural practices as well. The Egyptians, they practiced circumcision, but a different type of circumcision. They didn't do it the way that we did, which is that they did some type of partial circumcision. Don't ask me how, you know, what part. I'll absolve myself from that description. But yes, so there were some types of cultural practices. Now, another part of the linguistics is also another name that is Pharaoh's Seti. There's a Seti in Egyptian history. And Seti is a verb for rod of the law or rod of God, right? Right. And that actually also translates into Israelite culture. There is a Set being called Set in, you know, among the modern scholars. The modern Hebrew scholars, their pronunciation of what is assumed to be Hebrew words is not very confident because they know that they do not have the original pronunciations. In fact, the texts that they were left, that they came across or that they have, were written without vowels. So how do you pronounce the words if there are no vowels? And that is actually the genius of the ancestors who did write these things down. Because, you know, if you have use of the language, nobody will tell you where to put the vowels. And also, writing it without vowels allows for dialectical differences.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pronounce it in your dialect, and I should be able to pronounce it in my dialect. So being that the European scholars who happen to end up with the text, you know, I always say, if you're looking for our artifacts, our evidences, go to the grottos of the Europeans. You will find them in abundance, even till today. As recently as 1800s, 1900s, they were taking Benin bronzes and all kinds of things. They have them in their museums. And now they're saying they're bringing some back. You know, who knows?
That's stuff like that in the news.
Yes, yes. So, you know, most of our things that actually prove that we are a civilization, we do have intelligence, and we did have writing, they have them in their grottos, in their museums and all these kinds of places. But anyway, so I was telling you about the Seti being Ebegbe, and you find Seti in Israelite history, Set being pronounced Set, and you find Seti in Egyptian. So we should expect those kinds of similarities with Egyptian culture and language, because we spent 400 years is not a small time. It's a lot of time. So we should expect that there will be some cross-cultural influences. We would have influenced them and they would have influenced us as well. And in addition, some of our ancestors married from them. For example, Joseph, the daughter of an Egyptian priest.
So Joseph, Abby?
Of course. Joseph, all of the sons of whom we probably, well, the world knows as Jacob, all of his sons and daughters were other people. They were all other people. Joseph, you know, Judah, everybody, Levi, even Jacob himself, Isaac, everybody was other. And the descendants of the ancient Israelites are still other till today. That has not changed. So even if they don't speak Ebegbe, and they are not in Ebe land today, they still have Ebe ancestry. And we see that in a lot of the DNA. We see it in the linguistics. You know, the culture, especially the culture. If you go to the Congo, there are so many practices that are just pure Ebe. You go to Cameroon, they have some of their languages have pure Ebe in them. South Africa, you will find some tribes. You remember them. I think this is a track and field athlete called Caster Semenya.
Semenya. Okay, yeah. Semenya.
That's Ebegbe. Yeah. And there are so many more examples of that kind of thing happening. And now some of them have lost some of course, a lot of the use of the Ebe language and some of the cultural practices. For example, circumcision, a lot of them in Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, they'll do late circumcision. But you know, we in the West, we still do infant circumcision on the eighth day, which is what was commanded to Abraham. And that's an important part. The circumcision is very important because that is actually a covenant that God established with our ancestors, Abraham, who is popularly known as Abraham.
Yeah. So, yeah, very great information there. So I want to take it to religion. So the Ewe people, what sort of religion do they actually practice? Is it a mostly traditional religion? Because I see a lot of interwoven with what is written in the Bible, the modern day people call Christianity. But I do know there is Judaism. And then also there is the African traditional religion. If you go to some Ewe lands, like in, let's say, Porta region or even Togo, you see people practicing those.
Yes. Yeah. So all Ebes, wherever we may be, we all know about and worship God, the creator of everything. We are all aware of that. Okay. So all Ebes do practice and worship and acknowledge the supreme deity, whom we collectively in Ebeland call Mauga or Mau. And in other places, they may call him different things. But we know that this is that we collectively acknowledge that the Most High is there. Now, we do have pantheons, as you mentioned. They have, you know, as far as what it can be attributed as our indigenous worship, forms of worship, you know, we do have pantheons where the Ebes, you know, they have family deities, they have clan deities, they have tribe deities, so many of them. And the most Ebes will practice that along with whatever perceived European religion they have adopted, whether modern Christianity or Islam or modern Judaism.
Right.
So they'll practice that along with it. Now, what is very evident is that the Ebes, just as the biblical historical accounts state over and over again, the Ebes go against what Mauga decreed, which is that they should not worship, they should not have other deities in addition to himself. And in fact, if you read Deuteronomy chapter 28, the whole chapter, you will see the first part of it is blessings, where Mauga is saying, if you obey me, if you listen to my instructions, you do as I tell you, these are the blessings. And this will sound crazy to your to a European mind, because they'll be like, well, why do I have to do what somebody says? Why can't I just do what I want to do? Well, we, the Evers, we understand that we were created by someone, right? And that someone has wants and has laws. In fact, one of the names that we call for the Most High is Set, and Set means law.
Oh, yeah.
We call the Most High that as well. So we know very well that the Most High has his laws, and we are supposed to follow his laws, you see. So yeah. When God gave those blessings in Deuteronomy 28, he also gave, after that, curses. He listed a set of punishments that will befall the other people if they do not heed his warnings, just as a father would give consequences to their child if the child does not heed his warnings, you see. And so you can see when you read the whole chapter, the whole Deuteronomy 28, the whole chapter, you will see word for word, all the things that we have been afflicted with are listed there. You know, it tells us how we will cultivate our land. Somebody else will come and reap the fruits of it. It tells us that we will have land, but someone else will come and lay claim to it, and we will have no right, which is exactly what has happened to us. When you take colonization, for example, though we say we are independent, we truly cannot make our decisions. We don't make our decisions because Western minds are still controlling us. If you take slavery in Deuteronomy 28, it tells us that we will go into slavery. It says that you will be, I will send you again to Egypt on ships.
Right.
You understand?
Yeah.
He will send us again to Egypt, which is obviously not ancient Egypt.
Right.
He will send us this time. He will send us again, but this time he will send us on ships. Before, we walked in there into ancient Egypt ourselves in search of corn. There was a famine, and we multiplied over there. We became numerous. And so we didn't go there on ships the first time. But the second time, he said he will send us again to Egypt, but on ships.
So that's significant for slavery?
That's huge. That is huge because, yes, for the transatlantic slavery,
yeah,
specifically, and even the Arab slave trade that was ahead the northern part, was sent on ships. We are the only race of people. This is the sub-Saharan African people. We are the only, and we are of our own race. We are not the same as the mixed Ethiopians. We are not the same as the Arabized Northern Africans. We are of a race of our on our own, and they call us the Negroes. We are the only race of people who have been taken collectively in our massive numbers on ships to what is figuratively another Egypt for us, which is the America. The Caribbean, it's taken us into a land of bondage. That's what Egypt represents. You understand?
Yeah, absolutely. I get it. Is there a way out?
Yes. And that is also laid out in the scriptures, which is our history and our culture. And also it has obviously mandates from our God to us, right? And the way out is simply this. And it's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. It says, if my people who are called by my name, who are the people who are called by his name? When you see the name of God in the Bible, which is written, which is being popularly called Yahweh, it is written I-H-W-H. The H's represents E. So what you would have there is Yahweh. You understand? And Yahweh, even though Yahweh today, if you Google Yahweh, they'll tell you it is a cult in Ghana, which yes, that is, the name has been taken and applied to the thunder and lightning deity, right, in Everland, because at the foot of the Sinai mountain, God manifested himself in the form of thunder and lightning. So the people, some of the people from then, began to worship him as the thunder and lightning deity. So, but Yahweh is the name proper of God, the great most high God, Mawuga. You know, Mawu is not his name. Mawu is just a description to say that he is the one who surpasses all else. Mawu Okata.
Oh, okay. So that, okay, okay. It's like Mawu.
Yes. Yeah, because we have other deities, right? But he is the one that is above all them, all of them. Exactly. Mawu Okata. But Yebe is the proper name. And in fact, in Yebe is known in the western part of Everland, that is Togo and Ghana. But in Benin and the Ebes in Nigeria, they call him Yefwe. Yes, yes. And there is there are I guess you can say part of the Ebe Caliphate who call themselves the Hwe people. So they are also being called by the name of God. So as in Western Ebe land, we have maintained the original name. We have maintained the name, our name, the original pronunciation of our name, which is Ebe. So we are the Ebe from Yebe, you understand? So that's 2 Chronicles chapter 7, 14, which says, if my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will heal their land. That's all it's about. You asked, what is the solution? Okay. And that's the solution. We need to humble ourselves. We need to pray. We need to turn from the wicked ways. What are the wicked ways? Worshipping other gods that are not Mauga, right? Worshipping other gods that are not Mauga. Also not being our brother's keeper. You know, in today.
But just being a brother's keeper. So there is a whole stretch of the every people all over from your analogy. So I would can conclude that most of the people in the diaspora that might have were descendants from, you know, people were taken from Africa into the diaspora. So they might have some Ewe DNA or can be traced back to the Ewe people.
Mm-hmm.
With that, them growing in a different environment and then the Ewe is also in Africa or wherever that they also go in the environment, how can this group of people come together? Is it possible at all?
Yeah, first we need to change our attitudes about one another. Granted, you know, the West has done all in their power to keep us separate. That is why in America here, most people, when they hear about Africans, it's always in a degrading manner. Africans are presented that way. We are poor, we are needy, we are uneducated, you know, close to stupid, right? That's how it's presented to them.
Yeah,
and so who, even if it's you, you wouldn't want to be associated with those people, right? Because you say, no, if those are not my people, we're never like that, you know? And then on the other side, the Africans are also presented an image of African-Americans or diasporans as being lazy and drug users, which is far from the truth. So we need to peer into each other's condition and get an understanding of each other's condition. The African needs to understand that, no, my brother, the African-American, is not lazy. In fact, the numbers that are being published about drug use, in fact, it's the opposite. They are not the ones doing the most of the drug use or the cartels. You will not find cartels, drug cartels that are African-American cartels. No, there are other groups that do those kinds of things. But somehow African Americans are the ones whose face end up in the media as the drug child. You understand? And these are things that are done intentionally to them for a reason. Because the Bible says creation waits for the manifestations of the sons of God. We are the sons of God. So creation is waiting for us to manifest. As long as we are oppressed and we are kept from being able to manifest our full potential, creation will never get to its potential. You see,
there's a lot to be done. I see a lot of great programs that are going on between the people in the diaspora and then also in Africa.
Yes.
There is the Year of the Retained, or there's also groups that people are actually making a transition to go and try to live in Africa or just to get to understand. And likewise, Africans also trying to understand people in the diaspora, the culture, the way of life and stuff like that. I think there is a lot of positive on both sides.
Absolutely.
That can be put together for the common good.
Exactly. Yes, definitely a lot has been going on over the past, let me say, 10, 20 years, which is unprecedented, right? Yeah. So it needs to continue in that way.
Yes.
So that we can actually be unified and actually have our own power. Because as we are divided, neither our brothers and sisters in the diaspora don't have the power, and we in Africa don't have the power. But together, we will have the power. So yeah, we definitely need to continue in that vein.
Well, before I ask you my final question, I have one more question. This is a question that actually it's lingered in my mind for a very long time, even from like high school. There are a lot of debates on it. So there is a spiritual leader, in, I don't know, is the Asian Ghana kingdom or, you know, Gold Coast or whatever it was called at that time, but it was called Konfonoche again.
Yes.
So there are a lot of beliefs surrounding him because I believe it was said that he commanded the golden stool from the heavens for the Ashantis?
Yes.
Yes. But, and then also people have said he was actually an Ewe priest or traditional priest. So what's your take on that? Do you have any studies on it that you can share?
Well, what is available, of course, is, you know, what you have said. That is, people are saying this. So that's one school of thought, that Konfonoche being the one who is attributed with establishing the Ashanti kingdom. And the Ashanti kingdom, you know, only sprouted in the 17th century. Yeah, well, 16th century. It sprouted during the time of slavery. And contrary to popular belief, the reason the Ashanti kingdom sprouted was really to fortify themselves to be able to do slave raids. I talked to you about the slave raids, the Ashantis being one of the powerful kingdoms who were able to do slave raids against their neighbors, especially the Ewes. In fact, we had a five-year Ashanti invasion during a slavery time in Ewe land, where they had actually taken siege of an Ewe town for 5 years. Now, the whole reason for that kingdom coming together was for slave raids, to be able to strengthen themselves for that. They formed a confederacy. Ashanti is not an ethnic group. They are not a tribe by themselves. The tribe is Akan. They belong to the Akan tribe or the Akan ethnic group.
Okay.
But Ashanti is simply a confederacy. It is believed that Konfonoche was the one who, like you said, conjured up a golden stool from the sky, and that stool, he said, he put the souls of all the people who would belong to the Confederacy of Ashanti in that stool. So therefore, that stool became an object of veneration, and they began to worship that stool. Now, for me, as far as conjuring it up from the sky, I personally don't believe it, because I have seen what they have said is a golden stool, what they have claimed is a golden stool. I have seen it on videos and in pictures. And it's something very crudely made. You can see that, you know, the goldsmith really just hammered things together. It's not very refined, like something that would be descending from heaven. We would expect a higher quality than what this stool looks like. You see, you can still see the solder marks, the marks where they welded the parts of the stool together with the gold plates. You can still see those marks all over the stool. So me, I think if Konfonoche really was the one who produced the stool, I think he had it made, or he made it himself if he had those skills as a goldsmith. And yes, I think that being a priest, he would have definitely, you know, into some kind of spirit. And I suspect it's a warring spirit. He initiated it into a warring spirit. That's why Ashantis were able to do so many wars with their confederacy, going into other lands and invading and doing slave raids.
So what is next for you on your journey? And what final message do you have for our listeners?
Well, next, I am hoping to be finished writing my book. It's in the works, and then I'll be able to make that available to everyone. But also, you know, we have an Ewe Language School, an Ewe Language Institute, that where we're teaching diasporans the Ewe language, as well as even people who maybe have two or one Ewe parent, but they didn't have the opportunity to learn the Ewe by themselves either. So those are some of the people that we teach in the Ewe Language Institute.
Where is this available? On YouTube?
No. So anyone who would like to register for the classes, we do them on Saturdays at 6 p.m. from 6 to 8. That is the collective class. And also on Sundays, from 4 p.m. until 6, that's also another collective class. And we also do private lessons that is arranged between the teacher and the students. We have some teachers from Ghana.
Yes. And then also you do have teachings on the Hebrew, in the Hebrew studies. Yeah. That you do. I know they're available on YouTube.
Yes.
Yes, I've seen those and I've listened.
Yeah. On YouTube, you can search for Hebrew the Black Man. Hebrew the Black Man. That is, and then you'll be able to find my YouTube channel, which is called Hebrew Ivri Ewe Ewe the Black Man. But if you just search Hebrew the Black Man, you'll be able to find me.
Yeah. All right. So I'm looking forward to reading your book when it comes out. But also, I would want to say a big thank you for sharing the history, culture, and who the Ewe people of Ghana, Togo, Benin, and Nigeria, and other places are. This was very informational, and I believe it is for many as well. To our listeners, a big thank you for staying tuned with us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Uplift Chronicles, and please leave us your feedback on all our social media platforms, including our YouTube channel, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and others. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Uplift Chronicles. I hope you found inspiration in today's stories and the spirit of upliftment. Remember, every life has the power to inspire change, and every story is a thread in the rich tapestry of our shared heritage. If you enjoyed this episode, kindly subscribe and leave a review and share it with someone who could use a little upliftment in their life. Follow us on social media for more updates and join the conversation. Until next time, keep uplifting and stay inspired. Signing off, this is Kofi Dake.